It's different, of course, this moment right now from the attacks in September of 2001. But this pandemic, like 9/11, is one of those big, epic experiences that is taking up all of our psychic energy. And many of us, I guess the privileged ones, have extra time. So we're looking at the culture around us, trying to find something to help make sense of it. You've seen the dancing videos, the clip of isolated musicians playing the Ode to Joy. Some are binging Netflix. And some are reading and sharing poems. For the teacher and poet Joel Long, thinking of this moment reminded him of 9/11 and of the American poet Galway Kinnell.
Galway Kinnell was the first poet that I saw read in person. He taught at NYU and was about to start the poetry workshop. Of course, 9/11 happened at the beginning of the school year. So we had a bunch of new students who were there for the first time, some of whom had not been in New York for more than a week or so, and suddenly this event happens. So he went to them, and the graduate faculty was talking to them all, and he had, on the subway, written down a few lines, and in that first meeting with those students, he read those first few lines. So he begins with a description of seeing the towers, and then he imagines what goes on in the buildings to think about the individuals, a banker, a delivery person of sandwiches, a trader, a CEO, a chef, all the different people that were in the building. And then you get the plane hitting the first building. The plane screams low down lower Fifth Avenue. Lifted at the arch, someone said. Shaking the dog walkers in Washington Square, drove for the North Tower, struck with a heavy thud and a huge bright gush of blackened orange fire, and vanished, leaving behind a hole the size and shape a cartoon plane might make, passing through and flying away on the far side, back into the realm of the imaginary. As the poem goes on, he doesn't deal with terrorism. He doesn't talk about who did the act. He just shows the act itself. And then from there, shows the aftermath. The people coming out of the building, the people going down the streets of New York City after the buildings have collapsed, their faces covered in dust and ash and terrified. And then thinks about some of the people who were trapped in the buildings as well. Some with torn clothing, some bloodied, some limping at top speed like children in a three-legged race, some half-dragged, some intact in neat suits and dresses, many dusted to a ghostly whiteness with eyes rubbed red as the eyes of a Zahori who can see the dead under the ground. They swarm in silence up the avenues. Some died while calling home to say they were okay. Some called the telephone operators and were told to stay put. Some died after over an hour spent learning they would die. Some died so abruptly they may have seen death from inside it. Some burned, their faces caught fire. Some were asphyxiated. Some broke windows and leaned into the sunny day. Some were pushed out from behind by others in flames. Some let themselves fall, begging gravity to speed them to the ground. Some leapt hand in hand that their fall down the sky might happen more lightly. Now, clearly 9/11 is the great trauma of our lives up until now. It's a very different trauma than what we're experiencing now. And yet he gives us keys to how we might approach the tragedy, thinking about all those voices.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the poetry that comes from moments of crisis, what poems can do and how they work that might be different from a symphony or a story. Joel Long is joining us. He teaches English at Roland Hall. It's a college prep school. He also runs the City Art, Poetry, and Literature Reading Series here in Salt Lake City. And Joel Long, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Also, we have with us this hour Catherine Coles, who is the former Poet Laureate of Utah. She's a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. And Catherine Coles, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug.
And Jacqueline Oshiro is also with us, also a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. Jacqueline, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I guess I wanted to begin with this. Are more people turning, seems like more people are turning to poetry right now, and I wanted to just get a sense of how you three are, what you make of that. Kate Coles, you start.
It's my experience, and like Joel, I have been taught thinking a lot of 9/11 through this catastrophe as well, remembering how in the aftermath of that, there was poetry everywhere. And I think that in a moment of crisis, poetry becomes one of those places where we go to gain an understanding of where we are. Mark Strand says that a poem is that thing that tells us in so many words exactly where we are. And it does that across time and across space. So we come to it over and over again, the way that you on September 12th ran a live show, a call-in show that included a historian, a psychologist, and a poet, as I recall.
It's true. Jacqueline, what are you seeing or hearing of the poetry that's out there right now at this moment?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think people at extreme moments always want poems. I always get phone calls, somebody died, we have a funeral, what poem should I read? You know, I'm getting married, what poem should I read? People want poems. Again, I think Kate's quote of Mark Strand's idea, they want to know where they are. And so people are looking for poems that are going to tell them where they are.
I guess I wondered if you thought that it's supposed to provide comfort or perspective. Because I think that's not how you think of poetry.
I know,
Jacqueline, I know that's how you think, and so I just wanted to get you to talk a little bit about that. But Joel, why don't you start? This one of the things you've talked about is this: is you don't want poetry to provide something necessarily logical. So what is poetry supposed to do for us? I guess if that's the way to put it, even.
Yeah, I thought about this. I don't think of poetry as therapy per se. It's a way to perceive our experience through lenses of language. And that, it may provide some comfort, I suppose, but it may also press on grief and sorrow and loss in a way that makes it us feel it more deeply. And I think that's something that matters about the poetry that I've been reading. It matters about the poem that I talked about, that it shows us the event in a way that we can share in rich ways that have layers and layers of meaning underneath the language and the sound of the poems.
Jacqueline, what do you mean that it contains a moment in an extraordinary way? What do you mean by that?
Poem resonates. A really good poem just keeps going beyond the page, makes you want to start it again, read it again, because there it is. You know, you can't paraphrase it. You can't even describe it. So I'm in a bit of a loss here. But you're exactly as Joel said, you're experiencing it. You're in it. When it's a really good poem, it just gives you a reality you couldn't otherwise access, even though, again, it's across time, it's across space, you know, there it is. And you just stay with it and it stays with you.
Kate, do you, um, You think about it in that way also?
I think, yes, very similarly. A poem is a sort of mode of transportation, right? We carry it inside us, and at the same time, it carries us with us, with it across time and across space. And I would never think of a poem as offering comfort necessarily or perhaps even at all if it tells us where we are. Knowing where we are is not necessarily a comforting thing, certainly not right now, certainly not on September 12th. Being told where we were then was not something that was likely to comfort us. And even at a wedding, being told where we are might intensify and enhance our joy, that emotion of the moment. But it's not, comfort is a way of sort of taking us away from what we're feeling, whereas a poem will deliver us into the heart of what we're feeling.
I'm reminded of Paul Celan, the great poet of the German language, though he was from Romania. And what his parents died in the Holocaust, he was himself a victim. His poem, Death Fugue, which is in fact quoted by Galway Kinnell in the wonderful poem that Joel read to us from. This poem, Death Fugue, which he wrote early on after the Holocaust, the Germans loved it. They said, oh, you've made something beautiful out of the Holocaust. And he was furious. He would never read the poem again aloud, never, even when people begged him, even in Israel, you know, when Holocaust survivors begged him, he wouldn't read it. And he was furious at the idea that people understood him to have made beauty out of this horrific thing. He was doing something else entirely. And then he wrote very different kinds of poems, much more difficult. I'd still say beautiful in the sense that they're great poems, but much more difficult to bear. And those were the ones that he would read aloud, precisely because there is no comfort to be had.
What's the difference between prose and poetry? One has a sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end, but poetry takes on, I mean, aside from the obvious, but poetry takes on a more sort of abstract expression. Can I hear you on that, all of you?
Well, I can start with that. Poetry has its musical qualities, of course. Whether it's a formal verse or free verse, it starts with music. And so in some ways, the experience that we're trying to render is going to come in the vehicle of that music, whatever the language of that music is going to be. And it's contained by line breaks, by stanza breaks. So what can happen are jolts of language that the reader can take in and have that experience within that jolt, whether it's a line break or a stanza break or just a quick lyric poem. Like I've been writing during April, trying to write a poem a day. And it occurs to me, since I've been writing prose most of this year, that with poetry, there are like little jabs that I can take at the experience I'm having in the midst of the pandemic. Stabs at the grief, stabs at the sorrow, stabs at the isolation. And the lyric poem can do that in a different way than prose can.
This is Kate. I would add to that that, you know, Joel talks about those stabs and he also talks about the line, etc. Narrative offers you an experience over a long period of time. Poetry is much more specific than that. Poetry offers you, lyric poetry, access to a particular moment that, because of its recursive form and language, delivers you into that same moment over and over and over again. And when you reach the end of the poem, you can't understand the end until you've been delivered, in fact, all the way back through the poem to the beginning. And so what you have is this recursive moment that keeps elaborating and elaborating and elaborating. But even as it opens inside you the way that a universe expands and you are expanding with it, you're still not getting outside of it. Hmm. You remain inside.
Is this something that you have to explain to people, not to be patronizing, but I remember when I first started encountering Shakespeare as a young man, that the synopsis helped, or somebody who said, look, just let this thing flow over you.
Exactly.
Don't try to overthink it. Mm-hmm. Does it help to, I guess, offer a little of instruction to people about this is how maybe would make the experience better if you experienced it this way?
I like to think that if you give yourself over to the language of a poem, its suggestion will get you where it wants you to go. Poems suggest directions. they get ideas in your heart and mind. And I think if you just give yourself over to them, you can't go wrong. You know, maybe I'm a dreamer saying this. You know, my father used to beg me to explain my poems to him, and I would say, you know, Daddy, they're entirely clear. And then one day, you know, I finally sat down, I explained the poem, and he was like, that was great. This is a very good poem. Hilarious. You know, so I realized maybe I'm making a mistake here. But you brought up Shakespeare, and I have to say, I brought one of my daughters when she was 5 to a summer production by students, an absolutely terrific production at the University of Utah. And, you know, little kids are not used to understanding every word. They get things out of context. Yeah. And she was enthralled. You know, it was Twelfth Night. She says, when are they going to understand? It's not him. It's his twin sister. Yeah. You know, she was so, you know, I think people can get it if they do give themselves over to it, as my 5-year-old did that particular day. So one can hope.
Yeah. Well, Kate, you must have had lessons from when you would travel the state as poet laureate, having to have these kinds of conversations with people about poetry.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting experience, and especially since at that time I was writing, you know, 7-page poems about Kepler. And now I'm writing much shorter, you know, jabbier, to adopt Jill's language, poems that in some ways are much more oblique, and I think of them as being more difficult. But I would embark on one of these long multi-section poems, and I finally figured out that one of the best ways to approach it, first of all, I would tell people just to relax and that there wasn't going to be a quiz
right.
at the end, and just to engage with the language. But I got much less precious about the poems. And I would, let's say the poem had 7 sections in it. I would say, you know, I'm going to read a section and then I'm going to stop and see if you have any questions about it. I got a lot less reluctant to just have a conversation the way Jackie did with her father about what was going on with the poem. And even in the classroom now, especially with my undergraduates, part of my job is to teach them how to read really closely and really productively. So that's a piece of it. But the other part of it is to keep reminding them over and over again that there's not a lot of point in poetry if you are not getting pleasure out of it.
Yeah.
That giving yourself over to the pleasure, even of a painful poem, even of a poem that's delivering you into the difficulty of your moment, the point of it really is finally pleasure.
Joel, where are high school kids in all of this? It seems like they're in that middle place between adults who are overthinking it and like Jackie's daughter, who was absolutely absorbing it in a different way. Where are high school kids that you encounter?
Well, I do teach Shakespeare, and I try to give them the pleasure of Shakespeare, too. And I teach them the techniques that Shakespeare is using in his formal verse. But I also try to give them a lot of different poems. One of the things I'm doing right now with distance learning is daily I give them an announcement, and every day I read them a poem. Today I read an Adam Sagajewski poem about a cello. One day I read a Dean Young poem or part of a David Kirby poem. So just giving them lots of tastes, I think, is really important so that they may find, you know, one is opaque to them, but they might find entrance into another. Maybe they'll find one with humor works better for them, or maybe they're going to find a lyric poem like an ode by Pablo Neruda to enter into them. So I try to give them a lot of open doors, and I hope they walk through several.
Joel Long is with us. He teaches English at the Roland Hall St. Mark's Upper School, also runs the City Art Program of Poetry and Literature Readings. Jacqueline Ochsero is with us. She is a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. Her most recent collection of poetry is My Lookalike at the Krishna Temple. And Catherine Coles is with us, a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah, former poet laureate of Utah. Her most recent collection of poetry, Wayward, was published last year. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale. This week on the Preach Podcast, we're saying goodbye. Closing time. We've come to the end of our season, and sadly, the show itself. But the good news is, we have one last existential chat for you before we close up.
People were hungry to have these conversations. More hungry for conversation, maybe, than for answers.
That's Preach. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Do you remember those days just after 9/11, how people were looking for ways to make sense of that moment? Catherine Coles mentioned this earlier in the program. We had her on the show then, and one of the poems that came to mind for her was W.H. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939. There was such a creepy sense of relevance for that poem at that moment. I mean, September? And Auden's looking ahead to what would be a long and destructive war.
Auden was originally a British poet, but just as T.S. Eliot, an American poet, found his true self and vocation by moving to Britain and becoming anglicized, Auden found himself, I think, by moving to the United States. The poem begins with, of course, the date, which is the date that Hitler's tanks roll into Poland. Think about the level of threat that Auden is feeling. The world is never going to be the same. He's imagining these distant events that are also emotionally very near events, and he's positioning himself in a very specific place, one of the dives on 52nd Street. Uncertain and afraid. As the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. After he locates us in that time and place in the bar as Poland is being invaded, he gives us this kind of history lesson out of that. He wants to take us back not only to the birth of Hitler at Linz, but also to Luther. He wants to give us a sense of what has happened in Germany, what has gone wrong historically that has allowed this moment to come. And then he goes all the way back to Thucydides in ancient Greece. He was a historian who was particularly interested in the human psychology of crisis management. And then he brings us back into New York, into the skyscrapers, and then plunges into something that is also about crisis management and sort of the illnesses of culture, but is personal, and that's the relationship of the dancer Nijinsky to the ballet director Diaghilev, who sexually exploited him, and the way in which that relationship then went wrong, and you have that parallel with this terrible kind of historical sequence that has preceded World War II. We're back in the bar, and he says, from the conservative dark into the ethical life, the dense commuters come, repeating their morning vow. I will be true to the wife. I'll concentrate more on my work. And helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the deaf? Who can speak for the dumb? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state. and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die.
We must love one another or die.
He disavowed that line. He said it should be not we must love one another or die. It should be we must love one another and die. He changed the line, and then he published the poem with that line. And then he stopped permitting the poem to be published at all. This poem is sometimes accused of being sentimental, and sentimentality is really about going for easy emotion that is flattened out and simplified and not sufficiently complex. I don't think he does propose that solution, which is if we love each other, we won't die. The death that he's talking about there isn't the ultimate death. It's a matter of when that death is going to happen and the things that we have control over. I may be able to have some control over how many people die in the next 2 months in my town. What we're being asked to do right now is to make an expression of love for humanity in general by behaving in our own very specific, manageable ways, in the hope that more of us are going to have more time before we die. We must love one another and die.
Today in the program, we're talking about poetry created in difficult times. Catherine Coles is with us, along with the poets Jacqueline Ochereau and Joel Long. Kate, I wanted to say something about that particular moment. I mean, September 1st, 1939 came up a lot. It just became this, I guess it seemed obvious in some way, but that was the, it seemed like the poem of the moment that came to a lot of people's minds at that time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I've always wondered, because we did that show on September 12th at 11 o'clock in the morning. And I don't even think I have had that poem with me. I think it came to mind during the show, and I happened to have it to memory and was able to recite it. I've always wondered whether that was the first appearance of that poem on public radio after September 11th. I'm sure that if you had a really diligent intern, you could find out whether that's the case. But it absolutely is true that within 48 hours after that, I had heard it probably being read by Scott Simon or somebody on, you know, one of the big NPR shows. And after that, it really was everywhere. And it's because both of the specificity of the September 11th, of the September, of the month of September, the specificity of the place, Manhattan, that eerie quality that you were talking about. But it is also because of the ability of a poem to travel in time, to speak to us in the moment that we are experiencing right now. And this was a particularly good one for that.
Yeah. I was interested in writing a poem at the moment. Joel, you mentioned you'd been writing a poem a day. Cannell writes this poem right after the moment or in the moment. And I wanted to ask you about that, about all of that, about can you write in the moment about it, or do you need time to let it sort of work on you a little bit? Joel, you start.
I think it's tricky to write about something that is so present. And I know Cannell was writing about it soon after the event happened, but he also was writing it and rewriting it and rewriting it.
Yeah. Might have lost the connection there for Joel. See if we can get that back. Jacqueline, we'll jump in there if you would, because one of the things you've talked about is that you don't think writing in the midst of a situation often or can turn out that well sometimes.
Well, certainly not for me. I mean, I need I need, you know, it's funny. I don't think that a poem gives perspective, but I think that in order to produce one, one needs a little bit of perspective or time or to get a sense of where one is with all of this. I mean, I take Wordsworth very seriously when he says poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility. And I think one has very little tranquility in the moment. So we can point to all these really terrific poems that were written in the moment. I'm in awe of these people who are able to do that. For example, I myself in this time, I 3 years ago, I was lucky enough to be at an artist colony in Portugal, a place that could not be more like paradise, the Alentejo. And what am I writing about now? Finally, I'm getting to write about paradise of Portugal and its wild gladiolus. I mean, I'm not writing about misery at all right now. And I write a lot of poems about misery, but this isn't the moment for me. I think perhaps the closest I've ever come is a poem you asked me to read the last time I was on your show, and it was a poem that I wrote in extremely tragic circumstances, which was a friend of my daughter's, a young woman, took her own life. And I didn't write it, you know, instantly, but it was about 6 months later, which to me is very soon, because I was still suffering a great deal from this horrible reality. And, but, you know, as I think I said to you then, I mean, I'm a poet. That's what I do.
Yeah.
You know, I was obsessed with this fact. And so I tried to do something in writing about it. Am I sure that it's a good poem? I am not sure that it's a good poem. It was the best I could do.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I want to thank the audience for indulging us in this moment where it's weird having three poets in their homes trying to talk about all of this and work through all the transmission. We have Joel Long back, I think by phone. Joel, yeah. Finish what you were saying. And thanks for coming back.
I wish I knew when it blipped out. But I was saying that he was writing it and rewriting it and rewriting it and trying to get it right.
Yeah.
And he would read it in public, and when he read it in public, he would hear lines, as maybe a lot of us do, that weren't quite right. And strangely, like, he published the book Strong as Your Hold and has it printed, and with that has a CD of him reading the poem. And by God, he revises the poem in the reading of the poem. There are lines that are changed. So he was doing it constantly, and I think that's really important, because you are having to step away from the event itself, so that you're probably protecting the poem from sentimentality and trying to get the clarity that the poem and the event deserve.
Kate, talk about your process. Do you need, how much space do you need before you can get it right, I guess?
Yeah, I think that it really depends on the poem. I mean, sometimes a poem is absolutely rising up out of the moment in its first draft in a way that feels urgent and inevitable. But as with Jackie and as with Canal, it always takes me a long time to get it right. And one of my practices right now with poems is actually to, you know, I'll draft something and I'll throw it into a file. And I might not even look at it again for another 6 months. There's a poem I've been working on again recently that actually goes back to an experience that I've been trying to write about for almost 40 years.
Wow.
A friend of mine and I were trapped in a terrible and incredible thunderstorm trying to get into the campground in Arches National Park, and the campground was full. And we ended up driving out in the darkness in this incredible deluge to Klondike Bluffs, thinking we'll just sleep in the car and drive out tomorrow and get a campsite. Totally illegal for us to have been doing that, but it seemed like the only thing to do. And we got out there and we slept in the car. And when we woke up in the morning, that dirt road had completely washed out and we couldn't get out. We had, you know, limited food, et cetera. And it was actually one of the best experiences of my life, being out there watching, you know, cars drive out that road and then have to stop and turn around while we sat up there in our high space. But it was only in January that I returned to that poem and got something that I thought was about right The virus was coming into view at that time, and it was only about 2 weeks ago that I realized that in a way this poem would be read as and would always be in some ways about the time we're living in right now, even though its inception was 40 years ago.
I don't suppose you have it there in front of you.
I do. I just pulled it up while Joel was talking.
Can you give us a line or two?
Yeah, it's a line or two. I can tell you how, I can give you the last lines of the poem. And it's been meditating actually on the 40-year friendship that has transpired since this moment. It ends, "I remember so long ago, we sat on a bluff smoking, the road below flowing with water. We could not escape or anyone reach us. Blue sky after storm, food to last a day. I have never feared water, have you? How happy we were in sunlight, right where we were, unsaved."
Oh. It's Catherine Coles. Her most recent collection of poetry is called Wayward. Jacqueline Oshro is with us as well. Her most recent collection is My Lookalike at the Krishna Temple. And we have Joel Long with us, teaches English at Roland Hall. He also runs the City Art Program of Poetry and Literature Readings. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER listeners help make programming possible, including our special coverage of the COVID-19 situation in Utah. One way you can support this coverage is to donate a vehicle that you don't need anymore. We'll come pick up your car, truck, or RV, and the proceeds will fuel KUER's statewide service. Donate that unwanted vehicle today and help keep Utah informed. To get started, go to KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we asked each of the poets on the show today to talk about a poem that came from a moment of disaster. This is helping us talk about how poetry works and what it can offer us at a time like this. Jacqueline Oshro told us about a Yiddish poet, Abram Sutzkever.
He was born in 1913. World War I came and his family went to Siberia. His father died there. His mother brought him back, and then they were in what's now called Vilnius, but in Yiddish is always referred to as Vilna. There were many, many academies, libraries, teachers' institutes. It was really an extraordinary place to be a Jew before the war. That's where he was at first in World War II. The Jews of Vilna never imagined that the Nazis would come into their city and murder all of them. They hadn't built the gas chambers yet. They were shooting these people en masse into ditches. You know, he's seeing everybody he knows and loves killed. His own baby and his mother. He imagines his mother talking to him. "Don't, my child, it's a sin. Accept our separation as just. If you remain, I will still be alive, as the pit of the plum contains in itself the tree, the nest, and the bird, and all else besides." I find it incredible that he was able to write such poetry during the war, as all this murder was happening around him, as he was obliged to fight, to smuggle arms, to hide documents, and at the same time writing extraordinary poetry. Sutzkever understood that the way to make the tragic losses of World War II real was to give us individual people that we would remember, that would resonate with us. And then we have to try to sort of multiply this individual by all these millions of individuals who are being murdered. This is from Epitaphs by Avram Sutzkever. Written on a slat of a railway car. If sometime someone should find pearls threaded on a blood-red string of silk, which near the throat runs all the thinner, like life's own path until it's gone somewhere in a fog and can't be seen. If someone should find these pearls, let him know how cool, aloof, they lit up the 18-year-old impatient heart of the Paris dancing girl, Marie. Now, dragged through unknown Poland, I'm throwing my pearls through the grate. If they're found by a young man, let these pearls adorn his girlfriend. If they're found by a girl, let her wear them. They belong to her. And if they're found by an old man, let him, for these pearls, recite a prayer.
Give us those last lines in Yiddish.
Oy besweit gefinnen sei a bocher, soll de perl zirn sein geliebt. Oy besweit gefinnen sei a mädel, soll sie on es gehört zu ihr. Oy besweit gefinnen sei a socken, soll für de perl ton a twiele. Narrative maintains continuance, lyric maintains presence. And I believe that this is true. It's there for us, right there, present. We're in it, that moment, perpetually. Experiencing this absolutely horrific reality.
Jacqueline Oshiro. She's with us today, along with the poets Catherine Coles and Joel Long. Jacqueline, what are you writing these days? What are you working on right now?
As I said, I'm writing about Portugal and wildflowers and nightingales. Yeah. That's what I'm writing about.
Yeah. one about a northern flicker?
Indeed, yes. I have a poem about a northern flicker.
Tell us.
That's Portugal. Oh, I didn't pull that up, but I.
That's
could.
Okay. Tell us about it.
Well, it's very short. I think it'd be easier to just read it.
Oh, do you have it?
I do. I have my computer in front of me. Mm-hmm. I think I can find it really fast.
Please do.
I hope it's decent. It's written in the last few weeks. I never do such a thing. There it is. Flicker. Okay. Flicker 2. We better read Flicker 2. It's probably better than Flicker 1. Okay. Here it is. It's called Sightings Northern Flicker. Once pecking on a flagstone sidewalk, once preening on a telephone wire, and once a daytime meteor, or rather meteorite, crashing into an astonished tree. Its orange flash so quickly out of sight, I stop my car and scan the flustered leaves for his trademark face paint, polka dot breast, the thick black collar necklace that in ancient Egypt would signify pharaonic caste. No doubt he's a beauty when he's still, but the light, I found a feather once, an orange shaft fringed by a black oak leaf trimmed in white. That orange light transfiguring the air, that only shines when he's in flight.
Wow. Are you all finding time to write? I mean, you're in isolation. You should have nothing but time in some ways. But is it, what's the feeling of the time writing right now? Joel, what about for you?
Well, I'll tell you, we left school on March 13th and did not come back, of course. And that first couple of weeks at the end of March, I could not write. I just couldn't. I was watching CNN and watching what was going on and watching the press conferences. And it took me into April to actually write the first poem. And then I decided on April 1st I was going to try to write a poem a day. And I've been pushing myself to do it since. But it was real inertia. And, you know, part of it, I think, was the grief of the whole situation. I couldn't quite get to putting language onto the page. And now I'm just engaged in it. And I know that I'll write a poem later this afternoon and see what happens. It might be terrible. It might be okay. It might be workable. But I'm finding that engagement to be really important. I find the time because I make the time.
Yeah.
I put my butt in the chair, as they say, and close the door.
Kate, does that resonate for you, putting your butt in the chair? I mean, I guess you have to be disciplined and just write, I guess, sometimes.
Yeah, I've actually reached a really fortunate period in my life. It will probably come to an end, but it's been going on for a while, where the boundary between my life and language is very permeable and very thin. And I really am writing either poetry or lyric essays pretty much all the time, that the language is very present to me. And in difficult times like this, where I could get blocked up by just circumstances and thinking, how do I meet this circumstance? My response to that is just to respond to the language and not to think about that other stuff. And to trust that if the poem needs to deal with or reflect the circumstance, it will. And I'll see that after I've chunked it into my file and then come back to it 6 months later. And if the poem needs to be like Jackie's Flickr poem about my tyrannical young parrot, then so be it. Then so be it.
Yeah.
And that's what the poem will do. And that will be okay too. So for me, the job is just to not to shut that down, not to block that off, which I think could be a very easy thing to do, but just to trust that if the language is there, then I should receive it and I can figure out how to think about it later.
Who are you turning to? What poets are you reading right now? Jacqueline, what about you?
Oh, you know, I'll be honest with you. I'm reading what I'm teaching. And I was just teaching Auden and Marianne Moore. It was fabulous. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Before that, I taught Byron. You know, I love reading around in poetry. I love picking up an anthology and just seeing what I hit on.
Yeah.
So, but I am reading a good deal of poetry. It did take me a while to start writing in this period, but somehow I managed to do it at least first thing in the day, you know, before I start remembering all the things I have to worry about. I have three kids in New York and I was truly worried, but two of them definitely had COVID and the other one probably had COVID. And so I'm less nervous now because they seem to be fine, but who knows?
Joel, who are you reading?
Well, like Jackie, I'm teaching during the day, and weirdly, I'm teaching Life of Pi.
Oh, wow.
And it's like all of us are on life rafts with tigers. And so we're all sort of dealing with that situation of isolation that Pi is dealing with through the book. For poets, reading a lot of different poets, too, reading some Mark Doty, some Stanley Kunitz, Robin Becker's last book I have on my desk. And partially to get myself sort of moving and thinking on the levels that poetry brings me to, as well as to find some poems to share with the students on their live drafts.
Yeah. Catherine Coles, Emily Dickinson comes to mind for you?
I'm always reading Dickinson. I'm on sabbatical right now. It's very strange to be sequestered by my sabbatical and then to have the additional sequestration come in on top of that. But you know, Dickinson is always there for me. And I've been reading Blake again, which has been interesting. My old teacher, Stanley Plumley, the year anniversary of his death just passed. And so I've been looking back at a lot of his poems. And then, like others, I'm just kind of reading around. There are a lot of poems coming to me in my email inbox. Often poems that I would not necessarily have thought that I would have sought out to read. And I'm just reading all of them and hoping that something will hit.
Let me ask you, this is not a fair question with about a minute left, but do you all think that one of the things that may change us in this experience is that more of us may seek out poetry or art in a way we hadn't? I'll go quickly. Catherine Coles, what do you think?
Well, you know, we thought that after 9/11, and yep. I'm not sure that it lasted.
Yep.
You know, I think that people go back to their average day, you know, as quickly as they possibly can, that we try to return ourselves to that. And that seems normal to me. Yeah. But the poems will be there.
Yeah. Joel, what about you?
Well, I think as teachers, we teach the materials so that when students need poetry, when they need art, they'll find it. They may not find it all the time, not consistently, but they might come to a moment in their lives where they say, you know what, I remember that poem, and I'm going to go back to it.
And Jacqueline, final thought?
Well, one upside of the fact that no one has any kind of attention span is apparently that there are more and more readers of poetry because it's short. So let's hope that people continue to read poetry.
Jacqueline Ochsner, distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah. Our most recent collection is My Lookalike, the Krishna Temple. Catherine Coles, also, she's, by the way, the former poet laureate of the state of Utah, also a distinguished professor of English at the university. Her most recent collection is Wayward. And Joel Long teaches English at Roland Hall, also runs the City Art Program of Poetry and Literature Readings. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.